Everybody, this is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 301. As Greg mentioned last week, that's 103 backwards. That's about how I feel right now. yes, I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. I'm real fucking tired, and I'm probably gonna sound like it the whole show. Also joining me are James Jones.
Hi.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Five more hours.
And John is not quite here yet, but we think he will be popping in a few minutes. So we're going to go ahead and start without him, but we expect him to be here soon. Last week was a long show, and it has left some of us, although maybe not the ones you would expect, feeling really tired and exhausted.
I'm straight up balling,
yeah.
Son. Let's go.
I could go for Red Bull right now, but I don't have one, so...
Actually, John might be dead, which maybe that's where he's at.
Maybe he's just... He gave us the last drop. That's it. No, we're all fine, but things have caught up to me a little bit, and I've proposed that we keep this a short episode. I hope after last week's marathon that will be okay with everybody. So we're going to do new business and probably only new business. Retroactive, we're going to push it off because some of us haven't had a chance to play it yet. John's been too busy, I know, and I haven't had a copy of it because my system was stolen or lost. So I'm going to try to borrow one, and maybe we'll do it next week. Maybe it'll be 2 weeks. I apologize for the long gestation on this one, but there have been lots of extenuating circumstances in the summer, and hope you'll understand. Maybe after we do Wario Land 4, we'll get to the next retroactive fairly soon after that. So maybe we'll sort of do a couple bang bang like that.
John's here.
Hey everybody, John's here. I told you wouldn't be long.
That's right. As
John
a matter
Lindemann.
Of fact, I am here, Johnny.
Yay!
And I have some new business. I brought some new business with me, if you don't mind.
Oh snap!
Wait your turn, bitch.
I'm excited to hear about your games, John. But Guillaume had something he wanted to say.
Before we begin, I'd like to say that there has been some people experience having some problems using the new Apple podcast app and the chapters. 300 was a long episode, and you kind of need to use the chapters.
You don't need to. I didn't.
I just want to say
you don't
that
have to.
The podcast, you know, like if you're using that crappy app, stop and use something else.
Yes, the Apple Podcast app is horrendous.
Yep.
And so can you? I think you can still play them in the music app, though. I know I can on my iPhone. 4S.
I've never installed it, so I don't know. But I thought I heard that you couldn't anymore.
Okay, well, I am as of yesterday, so I think it still works. So you can listen to a podcast in the music app on iTunes. You just download it through iTunes, you know. Or what I would really recommend, if you're an iPhone or an iPod Touch user, I would really, really strongly recommend paying $2 for an app called Instacast. It is what you wish Apple's podcast app would be. It does everything that you would want a podcast app to do, and yet, for some reason, there isn't a free one that does it. So Instacast is I use it heavily. It's my number one, by far, most played, most used app on my iPhone, and it's really, really, really good, and it's totally worth $2. They update it, like, once a week with all kinds of little tweaks and new features and stuff, so it's really strongly supported, and, you know... You will never miss that $2, I promise you. That's the way to go. If we could get a sponsorship from them, I would. Seriously. It's
so go ahead and reward Apple's ineptitude by paying them 66 cents.
Irony. That's how Steve Jobs made his million.
That is cynical. That is really cynical. So let's start up new business. And Guillaume, we haven't heard from you actually in a couple of weeks since you weren't on 299. And man, I heard that you played... a shitload of games.
I sure did.
And they're games that we haven't talked about in a long time, if ever. So I'm very excited to hear about what you played, man.
True. We played a shit ton of games. And by we, I mean I was on vacation for like 2 weeks. And the first of those weeks, I spent actually with the people from Negative World. It's something that we started doing last year. We did a Negative World meetup, where basically we rent a house or an apartment, and we bring games and consoles, and we just, you know, play a crap ton of games. And of course, like this time it was done in Montreal, so I was showing them around the city. But we did spend at least one full day playing multiplayer games together, and that was a ton of fun. I hadn't met all of them yet, so you guys know how it is. I mean, like you've once met each other, you know, for the first time before, you know, going to E3 or PAX or whatever. So yeah, like, you know, things can be a little bit awkward, like seeing for the first time these people that you talk to on the internet. So we broke the ice actually by bonding over a disaster, Day of Crisis.
That sounds like a great first date plan. Yeah. Hey, baby, let's break the ice. Let's shoot up some tornadoes.
Hey, if you can make it past that, she's a keeper.
Now, don't worry. I'm not going to talk too much about that game because we've already, you know, given it more coverage and probably needed.
I have more to say.
Anyway, like, I remember that James said that, like, this was the kind of game that perhaps you would want some people around to make fun of.
No, you absolutely have to.
Yeah. Well, like, that's actually what we did. Like, we had this big group just watching one person play and making fun of this guy punching, you know, garbage cans and eating the hamburgers that were coming out of them. It doesn't take itself seriously at all. Like, I really think that the game knows that it's a video game and kind of crappy, and the whole like finding food, you know, strewn around and just eating it is very much video gamey.
Isn't it a kusage? Isn't it a shit game?
I'm not sure they intended to make one, but it is.
Yeah,
one.
Some shit games are born, not made, I guess.
What?
All I know is that because of, you know, that first game that we played, the rest of the weekend was just spent saying shit. And Steve, and it was pretty awesome. So that pretty much set the tone for the rest of the weekend. And but we didn't just play bad games. We also, you know, played a ton of things that you don't really, or at least I don't normally get the chance to play. I don't have a lot of gamer friends, and you know, like even the friends that I know that like video games, they don't necessarily like Nintendo games. But here, like, we were a big group of like-minded Nintendo fans, and so we could play whatever, you know, NES or Super NES or Wii game that we wanted. One of the big games that we keep going back to is WarioWare Mega Micro Games. Have you guys ever had the chance to play that multiplayer?
Yes.
I have not.
A little, but I mostly played it single player, actually. Because I, at the time when I got it for GameCube, I had never played the GBA version.
Oh, okay.
So it was completely new to me, even though it's you know, this, as far as a single player game goes, it's pretty much exactly the same as the GBA. But it was my first time playing it. So I spent a lot of time getting high scores and, you know, doing like the fastest possible version of every game. And I played a little bit of multiplayer, but not that much.
The multiplayer is just fantastic. The game keeps trolling you in every way possible. And we played that game last year for the first time, and I think that none of us had played it before. And so everything was surprising about it. We, you know, every time there was something that we didn't expect, we just burst out laughing. And that was the first game that we played. The second time that we played it, everyone knew what was coming, and everyone was dead serious. It was such a change of mood that I don't know what happened, but everyone became extremely competitive. But the game is still a lot of fun. There's modes where you can basically, you've got this e-reader and you keep picking cards out of two piles of cards. And each card represents a metagame or a microgame. And you keep getting more and more into your stack until someone picks the card for the e-reader. And then that person has to play every minigame card that anyone has picked in order to simply win that stack of cards.
Oh yeah.
And while that person is playing those micro games, everyone else can just go steal cards from anyone else's pack. And if the person loses one of the mini games, then that person loses all of their cards, and the next person to go might win them all. So until the very end, you really don't know who's going to win. It gets really, really intense. You know, like if you keep getting minigame cards and minigame cards, then like the stack gets higher and higher. But that means that if you end up playing those minigames, you might win big, but it's going to get tougher, right? Because you have to play so many of them.
So isn't the idea behind the GameCube version of WarioWare is that it's not like they made all the micro games multiplayer, but they put in all these multiplayer modes, and the meat of how you play them is you take turns playing these micro games. So they put these weird kind of meta things. Like, I think there's one where you're balancing on top of a turtle,
yeah,
and things get taught, like the more games that you lose or something like that, the taller it gets and the easier it is to fall over. So at any given time, the goal is not just to pass the micro games that you're playing. There's some larger objective, and the micro games are just a means to an end. So it's a nice way to take the content that they'd already created and put it in a new wrapper that makes it possible to play it as a multiplayer experience.
Yeah. Like, there is one mode where basically it's a endurance run, and you're all playing mini games, the same micro games simultaneously, and it's, like last one standing wins. But most of the modes are really like you play, each play their turn, and the other people just troll, like grief the hell out of them. It's insanely fun. And yeah, like that mode with the turtles, once you fall off your stack, you become a turtle, and you can go and try to make the other people fall.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
I hath become turtle.
So, like, even when you lose, you can just, annoy people and still have fun. In fact, perhaps even more fun than if you were still playing to win. There is this one mode also, one of my favorites. It's kind of this Othello board. Once the board is fully completed, the person with the most points gets to play a final micro game. And all the spots on the board that doesn't belong to him is basically covering the minigame. And if that person loses that one last minigame, then you get a lose and everyone else wins. That happened to me the first time I played it. And
awesome.
Yeah, like it's so much fun. It's so unpredictable. I really hope that something like this, makes its way on the Wii U.
How about this game on the Virtual Console? That would be perfect to always have it there.
Yeah, great. Sure. But also I'd like, to be able to play it online.
Oh, yeah.
This is Nintendo, so who knows?
So, Guillaume, what the hell is Super Mario War?
I'm glad you asked, Johnny. Super Mario War is only the best multiplayer game ever made.
What?
Yeah.
You just talked about WarioWare Mega Micro games.
I know that Super Smash Bros. Is really popular and all, and sure, it's a good game. It's all right. Super Mario War is this homebrew game that's available for the PC, but also on the Wii, if you've got the homebrew channel installed.
And I do.
Yeah. Well, I definitely recommend downloading it. You can play four players simultaneous, and it's very simple. It takes the Mario mechanics. You jump around and you try to jump on each other. It's got the same physics, more or less. And you usually have only a single screen. But the screen wraps around. If you exit right, you reappear left. But more importantly, if you fall down a pit, then you fall from the sky. And that makes for such a crazy, chaotic game. It's insane. And just jumping on each other might seem, like that must get old after a while, but the game is just packed with different levels, different modes, and power-ups, because you can have the Fire Flower, or you can have the Hammer Suit, and then, you become almost invincible, right? Like, the other people have to find a way to jump on you without getting a hammer in the face. So it becomes really, really competitive and chaotic. I don't know how to do that game justice. Like, it's so crazy.
So the only objective is to jump on the other guys.
Absolutely. You might have, wow. You've got different modes. Like, jump on the other guys, but generally just kill them. Like, you can kill them with a fireball. and different things like that. But there's options for everything. If you don't want the items, you can turn them off individually or all of them.
Well, you know, for tourney play.
Yeah, you can do that as well. Like, there's already, you know, modes for tournaments set up.
That's awesome. It's free, right?
I mean, it is free.
Fan game.
Yeah, I don't think that it's online, unfortunately. I would imagine that on the PC it is, but I haven't checked out that version at all. You've got tons of different characters that you can play as. Like, they didn't stop at, you know, allowing you to play as Mario and Luigi. You could be, you know, like Mega Man or Lakitu or like one of the ice hockey guys. I don't know how many people worked on this game, but it's very impressive, the amount of content that it's got.
That sounds awesome.
Go download it. That's all I have to say. Or just check out a video somewhere. I think that you'll see the appeal then.
Any video of anything.
The third major multiplayer game that I played, if not, like, not everyone played it for obvious reasons, but I played not one, but two full games of Fortune Street.
Is that a lot?
It is a lot. You've played Monopoly, right?
Yeah.
So you know how long those games can go on for?
Yeah.
Fortune Street is basically Monopoly.
Oh.
And it's kind of unfortunate because it came out at around the same time as Mario Party 9, I believe. And people made comparisons, you know, like they said, like, well, if I'm going to get just one board game, I'm going to get Mario Party. But the games couldn't be, you know, more different because there's no real mini games to Fortune Street. You're not competing every time you fall, you land on a square, just at a mini game and then trying to win it. It's really, you buy property and you try to get two or three properties in a row that are the same color, and you try to, you know, you buy hotels or whatever. They're not hotels, they're, you know, cute Nintendo themed shops or whatever, if you pay attention to what's written. But one thing that really differentiates it from Monopoly and that makes it much, much more fun is the fact that you can basically buy stock in different neighborhoods. So if, like, your opponent is buying all the green properties, once you do a complete turn of the board, once you go around the board and you arrive at the bank, then you can buy stock in that neighborhood because, you know, chances are that he's probably going to invest big there. And so every time that he's going to invest in it, he's going to give you points, he's going to give you cash, and your stock will rise. And that makes it, like, really, like, it really adds a layer of depth to the whole game. And unfortunately, the game could go on for like 2 hours, and it's not exactly a spectator game. So, like, I was mostly playing this while other people were playing, you know, DS games in the kitchen. But, like, it was a ton of fun, and it got mostly, I think, ignored by most people. But it's really a shame. Like, I don't know, like, if you're into board games, perhaps it's a little bit unfortunate that it can only be played in front of a TV, but I definitely say it's worth it.
Okay, yeah, that leads to my question. I mean, the thing about Mario Party is, I think part of the justification for it being a video game and not a board game is that it does have these mini games mm-hmm. that everybody plays together that are very video gamey, very interactive. It sounds more like Fortune Street could be an actual board game and doesn't necessarily need to be on the Wii.
Yeah, I can see that. I think the problem...
I mean, if it's just basically Monopoly, would you pay $50 for Monopoly on Wii? Probably not.
I kind of want to, though. I kind of want to get this game because, I don't know, like, sure, there's not a whole lot of video game elements to it, but just the fact that it counts, calculates the stock prices and everything, I think... really puts it out of the realm of an actual board game. I don't think that you could actually figure out...
From the complexity?
Yeah.
Well, it's also a vessel for Yuji Horii's characters to get into stuff. I mean, these are basically... most of the Itagaki Street games have had a bunch of Dragon Quest characters slapped on the front of them, so... Mm-hmm. It's basically just like, hey, Japan, you will buy this, won't you? Yes, I will!
Yeah, but they would buy it if it was on a pizza box. I mean, doesn't mean it has to be a video game.
The profit margin on pizza boxes isn't very big.
And this is a good game in its own right. I don't know. Like, I can see why people wouldn't really be interested in it, but if you are into board games, definitely, like, it's worth a look. And the game has, I haven't tried it, obviously, but the game has online multiplayer. So if somehow you can find like-minded people who are willing to spend 2-3 hours of their evenings in a, you know, continuous 3 hours playing Fortune Street, then...
With no connection problems the whole time.
Yeah, I really don't know if you can save mid-game or what, but I could see that as a problem. But I'm just saying, it's there.
It's cool that they included it, but that doesn't sound very practical.
Yeah, I guess so. But I don't know. Like, I'm considering it. I'm considering buying my own copy. Some people from Negative World already bought theirs, and I think there might be, you know, a couple of games online in the future. What else did we play? The DS really saved our asses on multiple occasions because we were 12 people in that house. And try finding, you know, games for 12 people. It's pretty hard.
Yeah.
The DS came close with at least 2 games that had 8-player single cart. Yeah, we played a lot of Bomberman on the DS. I'm not going to start explaining what Bomberman is. Figure it out.
If you don't know, just shut this podcast off.
It's about terrorism.
It is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yes. And encyclopedias.
It's set in a grim future when robots pull bombs out of their assholes. Yes.
Mechanical assholes. Horrible. Get it straight, Johnny.
And one more game that we played on the DS, 8 players, was Big Brain Academy. And that was surprisingly fun, although I only played the one game. The other guys had been playing it for a while. I just picked someone else's DS from them. I proceeded to destroy everyone, and then I retired undefeated.
So you played the DS version?
The DS version, yeah. And okay. The multiplayer mode is pretty simple. You've got, well, Big Brain Academy is really about these kind of, you know, simple kind of like spot differences or, you know, count these different things types of games that you would find in maybe like a kid's activity book. But you have to do them, you know, like you have to be the first one to solve a certain game to get the most points. I don't know. You just have to be constantly awesome at the game and you win just like I did. Man, like this was really hard to talk about.
It's okay. You don't have, trust me, 1 minute on Big Brain Academy is enough. You can move on to the next.
And thanks to this Negative World meetup, I managed to live out one of my dreams. I never thought I would get the chance to play GBA GameCube connectivity games, but I did. Pac-Man Versus and Forcer's Adventure. Pac-Man Versus is, I don't know, like it was a fun distraction, but there was this one guy who was absurdly good at it. And so it was less fun for the rest of us.
He was the Pac-Man.
I think, have you guys ever played that?
No.
Like managed to play it the way it was meant to be played with three other people? And
only at E3 a long time ago. Mm.
That would probably be a good question for all of humanity, really. Has anybody besides, you guys may have been the first people to ever do that outside of Nintendo. And E3.
Yeah, a lot of people seem to think it's really awesome, and it was just too bad that it was so difficult to set it up.
No, it is. It is. What really strikes me is, do you guys remember that Penny Arcade comic strip where the guy was complaining that he had to buy a TV and a four GBAs and hire 4 hookers and buy a house in order to play 4 Swords?
No, that was for, was that for 4 Swords?
It's probably for Crystal Chronicles.
Oh, that was for Crystal Chronicles, yeah, because they were mad at Square Enix, too.
So what strikes me as really funny is that we actually rented a house to play this game.
Yes.
It's the only way you could pull it off is to rent a house.
Yeah, we didn't really, we didn't go as far as to hire the hookers and everything, but we didn't need to. We had each other.
Wistfully looking off into the distance.
Look, let's just say that there were like, you know, 6 beds there and we were 12.
Oh.
Oh, wow. This podcast is going places I never expected.
All right, so Pac-Man Versus, I know that we're about to get the Wii U and different games in the Nintendo Land that are inspired by Pac-Man Versus, you know, like Luigi's Ghost Mansion. But I think it would still be, you know, worthwhile for Nintendo and Namco to bring Pac-Man Versus, the original, to the Wii U, because it actually is, you know, a genuinely good game, and Pac-Man is fun. What can I say? One person plays as Pac-Man on the GBA, and he's the only one who has the entire view of the screen of the maze, while the other 3 people see a fraction of the maze on the TV. And so, like, you really have to cooperate and actually, you know, shout to each other, like, okay, he's on the bottom right corner. And you have to cooperate to be able to catch someone, because otherwise Pac-Man really has the advantage here. And, of course, when you get the power pellet as Pac-Man, then you can start eating the other guys and you get more points. And the goal is really to get a certain score in order to win the game. And if you die as Pac-Man, then you have to pass a GBA to the person who killed you, and that person starts playing as Pac-Man. And, you know, of course, if you're Pac-Man, you can eat the fruit and you get more points that way. But if you're the ghost, you can actually also get the fruit, and then your view of the maze is enlarged and you get, like, the advantage that way.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, it's really well thought of. Like, it is really well made. I guess maybe, like, if I had one complaint, it's that you really only get that one mode. Perhaps, you know, so a couple of different modes would have helped give the game a little bit more longevity. But if it could be made into, like, a small downloadable game on the Wii U, then I wouldn't have any problems spending $5-6 for it.
Well, that's the thing. It was never really sold on its own. It was included as a bonus with, like, Pac-Man World 2 or something like that.
Yeah, I think the third
on
one.
GameCube, so.
Yeah, you had to buy a mediocre platforming game in order to get it.
Or I think there might have been, like, a standalone version if you bought a system. If you bought a GameCube,
I think there was a bundled version, yes.
Something like that, yeah. Hmm. But they never sold it on its own, and this was before digital platforms. So one reason not many people played Pac-Man Versus is it was kind of hard to get.
Yeah,
right.
They just didn't distribute it very much. So I think you're right, Guillaume. Is definitely ripe for some kind of re-release so that a wider audience can get to experience it. But they have to figure out a way to do it such that the connectivity can be done in a new updated way, you know, with modern hardware. And, you know, so I don't know if it becomes some kind of 3DS eShop title, you know, where it doesn't really matter if you have one TV and everybody's looking at the same TV as long as they're in the same room. Maybe that's how you do it. Maybe it's a Wii U thing. I don't know.
Yeah. The final game that I'm going to talk about is Four Swords Adventure. Now, that game you needed four GBA cables, four GBAs, and you each had to have your own GBA. And I'm not sure it was as justified in this case. Because really, the only time that you look at your GBA screen is when you go inside a house or inside a cave. And I guess it does add an element of not really knowing what the other people are up to. And if they're finding a lot of Triforce gems or, you know, while you're, you know, screwing around or just waiting for them. But yeah, like, it's still a very, very fun multiplayer game. It's one of those, like, just like New Super Mario Bros. Wii, it's one of those games where it's supposed to be co-op, but where there's, like, infinite potential for griefing. Yeah. And you just have, you know, you've got the classic Zelda elements. You've got different items that are taken from the franchise. Usually you can only have one at a time. And so, like, you really just switch between your sword and your special item. And, you know, you've got to cooperate that way. Like, perhaps you're going to have to lift some pots or lift some rocks. So one person is going to have the gloves. But you might also have to burn something down, so someone else might need, like, the fire rod. But the problem is that you're also competing to get these force gems. Then you can just, like, hit the other people with your sword. Or if they're in tall grass and you've got the fire rod, you can just, you know, make the grass catch fire. Well, they're in it, and, you know, like, it really pisses them off, but then, you know, like, all their force gems are yours. But you've got to be careful just how much you grief other people, though, because at the end of the level, you actually get to vote as to who was the most helpful and who was the most evil.
Right.
Yeah. So initially,
that's awesome.
You know, initially I wasn't, you know, griefing too much. So, I was mostly ignored during those votes, but then I was giving as much as I got, and, I became the hero of darkness. And, then you get, force gems subtracted from your score.
It's the douchebag vote, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with you that the connectivity is a little gimmicky in Four Swords Adventures, mm-hmm. and they probably could have done a version of the game without that. But you know, that aside, it is a great game on its own. It's just, it's really interesting. It was multiplayer Zelda, which doesn't seem like it should work, and yet it does. Mm-hmm. And there's even a, it sounds like you guys were playing the main adventure mode, but there's also a deathmatch mode, which again sounds stupid and pointless for a Zelda game. It's actually absurdly fun. Like, again, very simple, kind of like Super Mario War. It's just like you put four links on a screen and you just have to knock out the other guy's hearts. So you can use your sword, you can use bombs, you can use whatever you find. If there are pits, you can knock them into the pits. You can pick them up and throw them around. You can pick up a chicken and throw it at them until the chickens all start attacking. It's so crazy, and it's way more fun than you would expect.
Oh, wow. I wish we had played that mode.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, we only played really the first couple of levels, so we didn't get very far into it. But as far as I could tell, the game was not really as well, fleshed out in terms of co-op stuff that you could do as the Four Swords game that we got for the Zelda anniversary on the DS.
I think the GameCube Four Swords Adventures is much better.
Yeah, much better. It might be, but the...
I've played the one on DSi. I've played that one.
Mm.
Yes.
The one on DSiWare is... it's got more bosses and enemies that you actually have to beat two or three or four to be able to kill. You know, like, it had these enemies that you had to go on either side and start pulling on each side of its shell.
Yep.
In order to rip it apart. And the Four Swords Adventure, the GCN version, didn't really have that.
No, it couldn't, because it was designed that you could also play it by yourself. Control formation. But even with a formation of links, there's no way for you to pull on something from two different directions at the same time. So it's not going to have that stuff. But I feel like the level design overall, the presentation is just a lot better on the GameCube game.
Yeah, I would agree.
But it's not free. The DSiWare version was free for a time. So, I mean, I, you know, can't complain about that, but I just don't think it's as good as the GameCube.
I hate free things.
James can complain about anything.
Well, so that was basically the games that we played at the meetup. It was, I wish it had lasted, you know, longer. We could have gotten farther in more games, but just getting the chance to actually play stuff like Pac-Man Versus or Four Swords Adventures the way that they were meant to be played was already a big deal. And at this point, I'm not really scared to meet people that I've met in online, you know, like, it might seem a little bit weird, but, you know, like, I would say, like, perhaps, like, the people from the Nintendo World Report boards, like, if they've been talking to each other for years and years and years, you know, like, I think it's a worthwhile experiment, you know, like, all these like-minded people that you've only talked to through the internet. Well, like, meeting them in person, they're probably, you know, in most cases, as much fun as they are on the boards.
Well, that's a thing. I mean, we're not a role-playing kind of community for the most part. So, you know, when you meet, and I've always found this for, you know, ever since I started going to E3, the first time I met anybody from the site back in, like, 2001, and I've always found that the people, when you meet them in person, they're really just like they are on the internet. And that's because we don't play characters when we're online. We're working, or we're talking about a specific topic like Nintendo, and we're really expressing our real opinions. And so when you meet people online, they're pretty much the same. They just have a face instead of an avatar.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the personalities are the same, and that's the important part. And so whatever awkwardness that you expect that there will be, I've always gotten over it very, very quickly because of the kinds of people that we interact with.
I mean, once you get past that first kind of shock of meeting somebody, and I find also, like, if you meet people,
especially
when
they're only wearing pants, John Lindemann,
James, let's just leave the past in the past. All right.
In my nightmares.
I mean, but that's the thing. When you meet people from forums, typically a lot of who people are comes across in the forums anyways. Like, typically if they go through the trouble of taking the time to write stuff, that's typically you get to kind of know them through their writing, I find, a lot of the time.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Pants or no pants.
Whoa. I was implying you weren't wearing a shirt.
My bad. Freudian slip. Sorry.
Awkward. No, since Guillaume had such a big, awesome new business with all these multiplayer games, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, the rest of us will do our new business. Stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Alright, first up this week we have a blog called Of Nerds and Men, A Brief Affair by Zach Miller. Zach got an iPod Touch and played Tiny Wings and Dead Space iOS. He likes it, which means he's become part of the problem and is personally killing gaming. Tell him how he is anathema to all things gaming on his Twitter account, which he shamelessly plugged in this post. That's how we start now playing this week. It only gets better from here.
We start dealing at the very beginning.
We also have, and this is a real article, this is important. We have hands-on impressions of Mass Effect 3 on the Wii U by Carmine Red. I'm so excited for this hotly anticipated conclusion for a huge gaming series that absolutely dominated this console generation. If you lived in a cave for a year, Carmine's impressions will get you excited to touch-enable your femship all over the galaxy.
We have impressions of the 3DS XL by Aaron Kaluska. It may have its own gravity, but Aaron loves it anyway. While it has a ton of improvements that probably would have been welcome in the 3DS, it's also a boat. We've got a review of Kingdom Hearts 3D Dream Drop Distance by Patrick Barnett. It's Kingdom Hearts, which means it makes no damn sense, but you apparently shouldn't care because it's good. It also has Pokemon, which seems like a way for Square Enix to cut down on how much it has to pay Disney. But hey, at least its inexcusable use of 3D in the title can provide an opportunity for scorn. And very quickly, I'd like to plug my own editorial. This is not an Ace Attorney review, where I do not review the movie Ace Attorney, the live-action movie by Takeshi Miike.
Well, it's you know, I think the article's more about the experience of seeing it with really hardcore Ace Attorney fans. But...
Well, Edgeworth fanboys and fangirls, especially.
Mount Edgeworth fans, to be clear.
That sounds amazing.
All right, we have impressions of The Last Story by James Dawson. Three people running around in leather straps brandishing swords? No, it's not like that. It's The Last Story. Sakaguchi's third-person action title might just be the last big title for Wii. Thank the X-Seed for rectifying Nintendo of America's stupidity. And we also have impressions of Tohoku Daigaku, Karagakuken Kaiujo, Kawashima Ryuta, Kaiouju, Kanshu Monosugoku no o Kitareru 5 Funka no Oni Training by Danny Bivens. If you want to learn how to be an Oni, I guess, you can move to Japan, like Danny, or buy this damn game.
We also have impressions of FIFA 13 on the Wii U by Carmine Red. Curious how Electronic Arts is going to adapt people. Oh god, sorry, I fell asleep. Soccer's really boring. We also have a feature, Neighbors in Namforth Part 1 by Nate Andrews and Scott Thompson. Nate and Scott decided to play Animal Crossing on GameCube using an emulator and sharing their save file via Dropbox. In 2002, Nintendo would have counted this as online play.
Well done, sir. Well done. This Now Playing was brought to you by James Jones. We make fun and we have a good time on this segment, but all of this content is really good and you should go check it out right now at NintendoWorldReport.com. Okay, we are back and ready to continue new business, and John is going to go first here in the All second right. piece of the show.
I have a couple of legitimately old games and a retro game this week. On PSN, apparently iRem is taking all of their R-Type games off of PSN for some reason, I think possibly from all downloadable services, I would imagine. Sort of like how Sega did with their Sonic games a while back for some of the
services. Well, I think that I heard that actually their R-Type games were taking off the Wii. A couple of months ago?
Yeah.
That might have been only in Japan. Yeah, that might have been only in Japan, but I'm not sure.
Word came out earlier this week that the same thing was happening on PSN. So I've always been a big R-Type fan. I've really liked the series. And one of the games I always wanted was R-Types, which was released on PS1 back in, I think, 98. And what it is, it's R-Type 1 and R-Type 2. And I'm not too sure if they're like exactly like arcade perfect versions of the games, but they're pretty good. So, I mean, if you haven't played R-Type, it's a side-scrolling shooter. It's very, very, it's one of the classics of the genre, I would say.
It's, you know, hard.
It's very hard, yes. Very, very
it's
hard.
Real hard.
And what's interesting about R-Type 1, speaking of that, is the first time I played it, I was just cruising through, but it's the classic example of a game where if you get all of the power-ups in order, it becomes a ton easier. But if you die...
Oh, yeah, it becomes a cakewalk. It's just...
Yeah, Yep, but if you die, oh, you're in for a world of hurt, because when starting off with nothing... Phew, man.
It's sort of like Lords of Thunder, which we forgot to talk about on 300, where if you don't have your upgrades, you're fucked.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just grinds you to dust. But
you're gonna get man beamed.
But like that's like a common problem in those old shmups, right? Gradius.
I would say it's still an issue. I mean, the game that John talked about last week,
Castle of Shikigami.
The other one that with the blocks,
Blastworks.
Yeah, like if you're not upgraded in Blastworks, it can feel like just getting pounded into the dirt.
Yeah. Fortunately, they've kind of moved away from that. I think Guillaume is right. Back in the day, it was a big problem with all of the older Gradius titles where you were pretty much, I mean, you pretty much had to get everything in order and stay alive all the way through, because starting off, especially later on in those games, you wouldn't have a chance. You'd have to be really, really good.
The one thing that always pissed me off about Gradius in particular is that you had to upgrade your speed. Mm-hmm. And when you're not upgraded, you're just slow as hell. And in certain stages, if you die past the midway point, then you start off and sometimes you have no chance of getting it out of the way of enemy ships.
Yeah.
It's just impossible.
Now in R-Type, it's actually completely opposite. They give you speed power-ups, but a lot of times I wind up avoiding them because your ship actually becomes too fast to control properly, because a lot of times you're in really close confines because they have stuff that kind of drops down from above you, like, you know, like whatever, things that you have to avoid, like walls that come down. And so you're kind of squeezed into these small corridors, and it's really hard when you're trying to shoot enemies and like try to, you know, because obviously you blow up if you hit any of the walls. So
yeah, the walls are made of death.
Yeah. So it's difficult. I mean, like it's kind of, you know, two sides of the coin. It's like you have to be fast to avoid certain enemies, but then that also makes your ship much harder to control. So it's a tough game. It's really tough. But I mean, I'm enjoying it. I mean, it's a really good port of the arcade version of it. It's really and it also has R-Type 2, which is I haven't played too much of it. I'm still trying to get through the first one.
I think it's kind of just a continuation of the first game. Because there was a TurboGrafx version that had both R-Type 1 and 2 together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think they're considered almost like two halves of the same game.
Yeah,
almost.
It's continuing the same war, if you will. The fight against the evil Baidu Empire.
It's a direct story sequel.
Yeah, which is interesting too, because what they have in here was something that surprised me, is they call it like the R-Type library or something, but it's like a little encyclopedia of... Like, it's one of these things, like, sometimes I just wonder who kind of writes this stuff and who comes up, like all of these games that have backstory where you're just like, why did they even come up with backstory for that series? Like, there's a backstory for R-Type, a little bit of it. Like, they go through, so in this, you know, kind of encyclopedia part of it, they talk about, like, the events leading up to the war against the Baidu Empire, and they have, like, dates and everything and, you know, pictures and stuff and all this stuff, and they go through...
But if you didn't know how fucking evil the Baidu Empire was, would you really want to destroy it?
This is true. I am a peace loving individual. So you're right. To stoke my fire, I think it was probably mandatory for me to.
I don't want you to discuss your fire being stoked, please.
Anyways, so yeah, and there's also cool things like you can look at each. You can look at like a 3D model of each ship, which on the PS1 is novel. But at the same time, hilarious, and at the same time, horrifying, because the 3D models are just absolutely so terrible.
Is it made of, like, five polygons?
Yeah, they're like, you know, it's like how you can make a square look like a circle as well as you can, kind of thing. Especially with the options and stuff, they're pretty funny looking. But still, it's kind of neat, and it was, you know, more than I expected of the game. You know, it's it's, I figured it would just be, you know, a couple of R-Type games and just, you know, there you go. But, I mean, yeah. It was $6, you know, so it was worth the money to me because, you know, I wanted both games.
Oh, it's a lot cheaper than anything on Virtual Console. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get those games on Virtual Console, or at least you could. I don't know if you still can, mm-hmm. but it would cost you more than
that. It costs you $6 for one of them.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. Or maybe there might be a CD version, like a turbo CD version that has both, but then that would be at least $8.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. So, it was really good. So, I'm enjoying those. I mean, it's nice to have. I don't really have a current version of R-Type. I didn't have one in my collection, so as amazing as that is.
Is there a current version of R-Type?
No. I mean, the newest...
Yeah, there's the R-Type strategy game on PSP that I was...
Why?
I was always fascinated by. It's called R-Type Tactics.
Yeah, I have that game.
I mean, what tactics would there be? Just shoot the fuck out of everything.
Yeah.
No, it's like turn-based.
Yeah. Oh. Yep.
Actually, I don't know if we want to promote a 1UP article, but there's actually an interview with the guy, the RM guy, and his, you know, about his new studio. But they do touch on the different shooters and you know, that RM has made, and that mm-hmm. his new studio is probably going to continue to make. But he also says that he's a big fan of strategy games, and he did make the R-Type Tactics game.
So actually, there's an R-Type Tactics 2, apparently, and its subtitle is Operation Bitter Chocolate. So.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, R-Type 2, that's not a bad game. It's pretty – it's a little
it's
bit slow.
It's got a terrible fucking name.
Yeah, it has a terrible name, but just – you know, for
it sounds like a name that would get rejected for a Gundam series.
Yeah, it's interesting. I pre-ordered that game, and I pre-ordered it because as a pre-order pack-in, you got a little plastic model of the R9, which I thought was really cool. I couldn't resist it. It was really neat. But I mean, that game has just gone on to let's just say it's on the deep backlog. Probably not going to get to it. In the next 20 years.
Wait, did 2 ever come out in the U.S.?
I'm not sure. I think it did. I think it was really limited release. I remember
Operation Bitter Chocolate. Yeah. That sounds like Japan only. To
I
me. Mean,
I only see a Japanese release date.
It's not on PSN, I don't think.
Yeah. And then the other R-Type game I got was R-Type Delta, which is I'm not too sure exactly when this came out. It was probably I'm not too sure exactly when, but...
Well, this is a PlayStation 1 game.
This is a PlayStation 1... Yeah, it's a PlayStation 1 game. So it was
came out in late 98. But,
okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's a fairly late PS1 game, and it's all polygonal, isn't it, John?
Yes. See, I remember this kind of being touted, like, ooh, this is a big R-Type game. I remember there being... I kind of vaguely remember there being a buzz around it, and then it's sort of coming out, and it fell flat on its face.
I mean, like, shmup fans, the audience is pretty small at this point, so I don't think, like, were they actually expecting to sell millions?
Well, I don't know. I think...
Probably.
I think what they didn't expect is for it to look as absolutely horrible... as it does. Because it's,
oh, it looks terrible. I've seen it. It's
oh,
bad.
My goodness. I mean, I put it in, played it for about 5 minutes, and I just said, I can't look at this anymore. Because both, not only are the enemies in your ship these awful, chunky, squarish polygons, but the backgrounds are as well. So,
oh, yeah. And if I recall, the skins on the polygons are amazingly flat.
Oh, my God. I mean, it looks like your entire screen is Mode 7 Super Nintendo. Like, it just everything looks like it. It just looks terrible.
I was thinking it looked like Doom 3D circa, like, 94.
Yes. Yeah. That's probably more apt. It's,
isn't that the way that every PlayStation 1 game looks?
No,
because this would have come out about the same time as Einhander, the Square shoot 'em up game for PS1, which looks amazing. I mean, and it's the same kind of game.
Well, that's the thing. Every 3D game, every game that was attempting to use 3D polygons would have looked like this. But that's the whole thing.
No, but Einhander is polygonal.
Is it? I haven't played it.
It looks really
is
good.
Is it? I thought it was sprite-based.
Well, so was Radiant Silvergun was also sprite-based.
That was for Saturn, but yeah.
Let's not get the Saturn involved because of its fucked up architecture.
That's true, it's true. But yeah, they were all kind of looking like that. But that does not look as bad as this.
It's just natural that squares look better than triangles.
Oh, man. But yeah, this is an ugly game. And I mean, the worst thing is, I mean, that I'm just, okay, I can understand the ships. I can understand, you know, your enemies and everything. But why they made the backgrounds, like the you know, there's like, you know, these skyscrapers in the background. And they just look awful. Like, really, really bad. I mean...
Well, if you think the city looks bad, just wait until the sewer level.
Yeah.
But, no, I played actually quite a bit of that game. I can't really get that far. I don't think I've gotten to the second boss. so I can't speak too much about it. But and I did skip the whole PlayStation 1 and 64 gen, so maybe my expectations were not exactly like yours, but I expected it to look bad, and it does look bad, but to me there's like I don't know if I can tell the difference between a high-end PS1 game and a, you know, a bad-looking one.
Well, I was just surprised they went all the way with the polygons.
You know, if you compare it to some of the games that came out on the Saturn, it's embarrassing because the Saturn sucks at 3D and it looks better than that.
Mm-hmm. Really?
I'm looking at images on the internet right now, and to me it looks okay, but maybe this just because they're thumbnails,
yeah,
and they're not, you know, they're not blown up full size.
Just imagine it looks like everything is just flat surfaces and then its textures just painted on.
You really have to see it in motion to.
It looks like Minecraft.
Ooh,
it's like that. That's actually, wow, a pretty good description of it. It's pretty bad looking.
Like at least the frame rate is solid, and mm-hmm, it's got some couple of good ideas in there. I mean, like you can have different types of ships that will give you different types of weapons once you upgrade them. And
yeah,
the sewer level is pretty cool. You can go underwater, and I can't remember, but I think that the music changes when you go underwater. Like it does get that kind of underwater sound. It's got a couple of tricks up its sleeve.
Yeah. I'm gonna keep playing through it just to.
One more improvement that it has over the previous ones is that you can actually select your speed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're going too fast, just slow down, and it's just a matter of using the shoulder buttons, and you can speed up and slow down.
If you're going too fast, go faster.
Yeah, that certainly would have been nice in the original R-Type, I can tell you that. It's hard to go back to that. It's hard to go back to that now. Like when that was the only thing on the market, you could kind of tolerate it, but now it just looks really, really bad. Just like going back and playing, like you know, like James said, playing Doom now, it's like, this is neat, but wow, it looks bad.
Well, the thing is, though, people didn't tolerate it, because I don't think R-Type Delta did that well, did it?
No, I don't think it did.
Well, look, 1998 was a terrible time for 2D side-scrolling shooters.
Fair.
They're actually more popular now than they were back in the late 90s.
I just seem to recall that game getting a decent amount of negative buzz.
Yeah, well, it's like if you released a game with a plastic guitar right now. Doesn't matter how good it is, people are going to shit on it. It's very, very unfashionable.
I'm sure with that series, too. It's such an iconic series. People were like, this is not what I expected at all. And then, you know, just the flaming begins kind of thing.
So, all I'm going to say is that I still have R-Type Delta in my PlayStation 3, and I've deleted Soldner X2.
Yeah.
Oh!
Because its mere existence offended me.
I can understand that. I can understand that. Soldner is... It's an interesting one. It's a very German game, I'll tell you that. All right. Now the final game I have this week is Sound Shapes for PS3.
I want to hear about
this. Yeah, it was pretty cool because I didn't realize that they were actually selling them as a bundle, the PS3 and the Vita version. So at some point down the line I will get a Vita. So hey, what the heck. Sound Shapes was a game I would have wanted anyways. So pre-ordered it, and there you go. But so it's a platformer. It kind of, if I was to describe it, it kind of reminds me of a mix between, like, has sort of the look of like something like Pixel Junk Eden, controls sort of like something like Super Meat Boy, and it has sort of a collecting. It has like an editor sort of create your own area sort of thing, and you can collect stuff Little Big Planet. Very, very much the same.
But isn't it made by the dude who made Everyday Shooter?
Yes, yes, made by Jonathan Mack and a host of other people that helped him with it. But
that game is awesome.
Yeah, Everyday Shooter is great. So it's very much the same kind of aesthetic look, like a lot of solid colors and angular sort of, you know, platformer levels. And the idea is that you're this little kind of blob, this little circular blob that kind of has two states. It can either be slow, and it can stick to other surfaces, particular surfaces, or it can be fast and unable to stick to surfaces. And so the way the game is structured is you have, because it's all, centered around music, what you do is you move through, you know, each area. There's multiple rooms to each level, and you collect notes. They don't really look like notes. They're just kind of circles. It's all very, everything's either cubic or circular or spiky, something like that. It's all very, very abstract, but music is always playing throughout. And as you pick up notes, different elements drop into the track that plays along with you as you're playing the game. So, you know, maybe a snare drum will come in, a piano will come in, maybe like a banjo will start playing, something will happen. So by the time you get to the end, And the end is nothing more than you touch, a record player is at the opposite side of a certain room after you've played for, however long. You've gone through all the rooms and everything, collected everything you need to collect. And, you just go over and you touch the record player and you're done. That's it. It grades you on how many notes you found and your time.
For some reason, I thought that this game was supposed to leverage a lot the touchscreen of the Vita.
It may. I'm not too sure.
I think that's mainly for the level editor.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So in this case, the editor is, you have a grid and you place elements on the grid. So there's constantly a bar that moves across the screen in time from left to right, and sort of like notes on a chart. As you put elements in, the tune that's playing changes. And so that's kind of like that's how each room operates. I haven't gone into the editor as of yet, so I'm not too sure, but I'm assuming that you probably create it room by room, and you determine what you collect in the room determines what music plays as the player goes through it.
So the music is sort of procedurally generated based on the level design?
Yeah, it's based on what you dictate what gets played by setting up elements within the level that the player has to collect.
Wow, that's cool.
I think there's other elements too, like obstacles. Some things, you have little volcanoes that, that spit rocks up and stuff like that. And they also play certain sounds. So you can sort of lay a groundwork of kind of mandatory sounds and that will play no matter what, even if you don't collect anything. And then you layer in items to collect that add even more sounds to the overall tune.
So then is there a browser like in Little Big Planet where you can just go download things that other people have made?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm down. Yeah. So do you like the way does it feel like a good 2D platformer? Does it play? Does it kind of control like you would want it to?
Yeah. I mean, it controls a lot like Super Meat Boy sort of thing. You know how it kind of has your little blob, in Super Meat Boy, but how he kind of has, you don't feel, it's not very floaty. It's kind of, there's, your guy has a lot of weight to him. It's like that.
But he's fast.
He's fast, controls very fast, especially you hold down like square to change your blob into like a tight little circle so he can go fast, but he can't stick to stuff. So, and they switch that up a lot. So in some areas, it's more of almost a climbing game where you have to jump, you'll have moving platforms where you have to jump up, stick to one, and then roll around it up on top, and then jump over to something else, stick to it, and just keep doing that. And then you might have to like hop up into a little tube and speed across. So there's some puzzle solving as well. So, in one of the levels, it's kind of has like an office building theme to it. So you have to go over and, there's a guy, over on one side of the screen drinking coffee, and you have to jump up and bonk him on the head, which a platform lowers. You hop on the platform and go up to the next level. So there's some light puzzle solving in there as well. So it's really cool. I mean, I'd like to actually play it on Vita with some headphones on, because I think that would be really, really good. More so than just playing it over, on a console with speakers, but it's still a lot of fun.
The thing about the music being procedurally generated, though, that blows my mind, though, because doesn't Beck have a couple of songs in there?
Beck, I don't know. I know that that Deadmau5 does. He does one. The different worlds are actually, they're called albums, and each album has four tracks to it.
So they're really EPs.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
False advertising.
Yep. Yep. So yeah, they're certainly not LPs. They're not long players. So, there's like, I guess, some other kind of nerd famous people were involved, like Cappy, Super Brothers, Jim Guthrie. I don't know any of these people, but apparently they're notable, like in terms of that kind of like electronic music.
Jim Guthrie did the music for Super Brothers, Sword and Sorcery.
Okay. Yep.
John, would you consider yourself to be nerd famous?
I don't know, man. I don't give myself enough credit to be nerd famous. I don't know. But yeah, Sound Shapes, it's pretty good if you dig platformers, and if you're a music fan and like to create sort of that kind of stuff. Check it out.
All right. So I'll go next with new business, and I don't have a whole lot, but I'll tell you why, because I was in Yellowstone last weekend. So, and before I went to Yellowstone for the weekend, I had some friends getting married there, and I was in the wedding, and before that, I was scrambling to get RFN 300 recorded before I left, and I did get most of it recorded before I left. But thanks very much to James and John for doing the segment with Greg. And it's too bad Neil couldn't be on it, but I understand he was sort of still tied up in vacation as well.
In Zach's basement.
And, and of course, thanks to Guillaume for editing and putting it all together, which must have been hell on your computer.
For you, seeing episode 300 edited was the greatest moment of your life. For me, it was Sunday.
It was pretty amazing because I was on like the worst, shittiest edge network connection in Yellowstone National Park that you could imagine, just desperately checking to see if RFN 300 had gone up yet. And it went up right before the Mars rover landed. Now you tell me which is the greater example of human ingenuity. A 5-hour Nintendo podcast about Wii or a nuclear-powered truck on another planet.
I can tell you, only one of those has Greg Leahy.
That you know of.
So anyway, that's part of the reason I'm really tired. Also, on my way back Monday, I was in the car for like 13 hours to come back to Colorado. So it's been a long couple of weeks. I haven't played nearly as many video games as I would like, because when it comes to the choice between video games or sleep, lately I've been choosing neither. So I'm hoping to change that soon. I did get to play a little bit more of the On the Rain Slick Edge of Precipice of Darkness Penny Arcade Adventures 3 on my, because it runs on my netbook, because it's basically a Super Nintendo RPG. So it runs fine on my netbook. And so I did get to play a little bit of that in the car when my friend was driving. And it continues to be really great. I think I'm on the final boss now, and I just haven't had a minute to sit down and finish it. But the game never really gets very hard. I think I'm playing it on normal, and it's really not that difficult. There are a couple other higher difficulties if you want to, but I've never been all that interested in playing really difficult Japanese RPGs. That's just not what it's about for me. I just enjoy going through it and unlocking all the skills and seeing the story and all the different enemies. And the game just has a great sense of humor. It's really fun. I mean, the kinds of jobs you can get are so funny, and every skill that you unlock, you know, from the job system has a funny name and it does something hilarious. And I mean, there's a job where your character turns into dinosaurs. That's a skill that you can have, that you can spend a magic point and turn your dude into a dinosaur, and then he attacks for like 3 turns automatically and use all these crazy different skills.
Is Zach Miller aware of this?
Now, I don't know if he is yet, but you can also turn into Cthulhu, so there's even another reason for Zach to be interested in, probably. The game is really a lot of fun. It's very fast paced. I mean, the whole thing is like less than 10 hours. So, you know, if you're someone like me who, finds it difficult to play through long games, I think this is a good choice. They do a lot of things that make it faster paced than a real traditional Japanese RPG. It's a lot of fun. So, I mean, for $5 or $3 or whatever the hell they're charging for it, I think you can't go wrong with it, really, if you're into these old 16-bit RPGs. It's really good. There's a lot of great there's a lot of great callbacks to Final Fantasy IV and Final Fantasy V and Final Fantasy VI and some other RPGs from that era as well. And,
Final Fantasy VII.
No. Thankfully not. But no, it's really great. So I've been enjoying that, and I don't have a whole lot new to say about it, but that is what I've played the most of the past couple of weeks. And before the trip, before RFN 300 got a little too hot and heavy, I did get to play several hours of Deus Ex Human Revolution.
Oh!
Yeah. And so I did want to talk about it. I've mentioned it before, but I haven't really talked about the game. And I know James played through it several months ago. And this is a really interesting game, and I'd never played Deus Ex game before this, but I was really curious after hearing a lot of coverage, and I thought the graphic style was interesting and different, and you know, just kind of fresh, and the idea of the game seems really cool because it's this first person action game where you can play it like a shooter, but you can also play it like a stealth game, and you can also play it almost like a Western RPG where you have dialogue trees and you're trying to get out of situations through talking alone. And you can mix all of these different things together. So you don't have to choose a path. You don't have to play it just as a shooter or just as a stealth game or, you know, anything like that. You can mix all this stuff together. And I think the game does a nice job of encouraging you to do that. So you play this cybernetic character who has all these weird abilities that you unlock as the game goes on.
Named Adam in a very unsubtle move by...
Yeah. Oh, the game isn't very subtle about anything, quite frankly. You know, the story is a little ham-fisted, but at the same time, I think it's really fun because it is this great sort of cyberpunk future. It's a lot, you know, like a William Gibson kind of novel or a Neal Stephenson Snow Crash kind of a thing. And I think it does a nice job of capturing that feel and setting up that kind of world. And the story is interesting enough. There's a fair bit of political intrigue and like corporate espionage and stuff like that, you know, that it feels like the stuff you're doing is, I don't know, just unusual. You know, you're not going out in a war field and killing 500 dudes. It's not about that.
It walks the fine line between espionage, intergovernmental spying, and just plain old thuggery. I mean, yeah. It really does feel like, you know, there's shady goings on at these organizations that get these really big military contracts. And
right. Sometimes you just need to sneak into a dude's apartment and kill him.
Yep.
Or steal whatever is in his bedroom without killing him. You know, it's kind of up to you, but you know, it basically comes down to whatever you think is easier. It's not really a moral game. They're not really tracking the ethics of your decision making. It's more about look at the situation, figure out how do you like to play the game? What are you good at? What is your character spec'd out for? And do it whatever way you think will be the most effective. And I really like that, where you're not thinking about, man, it's like, you know, it's not like in Mass Effect where you feel like, well, I kind of need to make this certain decision in order to be consistent with everything I've done right up to now, or else I'm going to be somehow penalized. And it doesn't feel like that. It feels like every situation you get into, every mission, you really can mix all these different skills and solutions to problems in whatever way you feel is best in that moment. And whatever way you pick is fine. And I really like that feeling. It's like if I make a poor decision, it's because it didn't work. That's the only way I know is like, hey, I should have done those things in a different order. Or I really probably shouldn't try to kill this guy because I'm just not that good at shooting in this game.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I think the worst thing is when a game kind of gives you options, but they're not really options. Because only one of them is really all that works.
So the only time I had problems with it a lot was during the boss fights. If you aren't specced out to fight, then you aren't going to win. Because, I mean, the bosses do have some traps in their stages you can engage, but they're never enough to kill them.
Yeah, so supposedly the boss battles are actually made by a completely different studio, and they just kind of shoved them into the rest of the game. And I've only played one boss so far, but it felt like that. It was really incongruous with everything I'd done.
It's kind of like a Gears of War boss fight. I mean, you're basically hiding behind the first one, especially because he's this big fucking meat dude.
And
he just spews gunfire out of every orifice imaginable.
Yeah.
But, I mean, later ones are pretty similar. You know, you fight somebody who can go invisible and then comes up behind you and just beats the living shit out of you. I mean, that's the kind of stuff in the game, but you can't talk your way out of those boss fights. They have to die. Or you can't stealth your way out of them. I mean, cause they're in the way. So I've heard people say that they beat the game without firing a shot except in the boss fights, but I don't know how you would do it. Cause I mean, you would be so ill prepared for those fights.
Yeah, I mean, and luckily, you know, I'm playing the game far after it originally came out, and so I've heard these things, and so I knew that even if going through the missions, I wasn't really using my gun all that often, I knew to occasionally throw an upgrade in that direction just in preparation, because I'm going to need at least a modest amount of build-up,
right,
of character development in that direction in order to make it through the boss fights. And look, that's not ideal, but I can deal with it, you know, and I can avoid most of the frustration, since other people have walked this path ahead of me. But the boss battles are ultimately a very small part of the game, and I think it's a poor reason to avoid this game because it's really fun. It's really just a great setting, and you know, playing through it, I keep feeling like I'm surprised at how good the stealth is, at how engaging and tense it is, and how much fun it is, and how satisfying it is when you get through an area and nobody's seen you. Because it does feel like it really takes skill and patience. And it's doing really a lot of the same things that the original Metal Gear Solid did. You know, you're hiding behind boxes, you see these guards walking around, you're waiting until they pass, and then you're kind of jumping over to the next bit of cover before they see you. And it's not anything super fresh. I just feel like it's executed really well. And it gives you kind of interesting locations where there's a lot of boxes and things, you know, little tunnels you can go through. There's tons of air ducts, vents that you can crawl through. Those are really fun. And I just feel like, to me, this is what Metal Gear Solid has been trying to do for years. And I think Deus Ex actually does it better. I really do. Like, sneaking around, like getting into an office where you're not supposed to be and hacking the computer before the guard comes up and sees you, that's exciting. It really feels cool. Because there is hacking, there is like stealing things out of people's rooms. You know, there's like looting bodies after you knock someone out, but without killing them. And like there's a lot of elements of this. And of course, you get experience from all this stuff that you can then you go to use and upgrade your character. And I keep thinking about like my great memories of playing Shadowrun on Super Nintendo. And this is a cool game. It really, really is. And it's not quite what I expected. It's much less of a shooter. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy about that. And the stealth gameplay, which I usually don't like that much in video games. I mean, I don't even really like it very much in the Metal Gear series. And I feel like it's actually done really well in this game.
I tried to play the original Deus Ex and System Shock 2 back in the day. And those games always, I never got very far into them because they always frustrated me because it always seemed like your character at the beginning was completely inept at the most basic things, you know, without upgrades. So does it feel that way? Like, does it feel like you'd be better off being a regular human doing these things than the cyborg who apparently has to pour all of his experience points into, you know, the shoelace tying skill, otherwise he's going to be tripping every five steps, you know.
Adam feels like a badass at the start.
Okay.
But he becomes so much more of a badass late in the game.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
See, my character was predicated on, I was very stealthy, but I didn't want to be surprised from behind. So I was stealthy, and also I killed the crap out of anything that I could when they walked past me. So I left, which means you had to be sure to hide dead bodies. You had to put them in places where people weren't going to look for them. Security cameras would screw you over if you played that way. Other patrols. So I had a lot of stealth stats and a lot of just pure on physical firepower. And that for me, that made Adam just feel like a ridiculous amount of death. Because, I mean, if you fight physically and you boost his actual physical fighting skills, like, you can punch just random hoods, like, through walls. I mean, not literally. You just punch them and they go flying. It's like, yeah, bite me. Because as you walk through, like, gang war Detroit, it looks like something out of Judge Dredd. And just start punching the crap out of stuff. It's just – it's really satisfying. Until the police show up.
I mean, I was in one mission in Shanghai where I was infiltrating this nightclub, and I had gone way down to the basement to like eavesdrop on a conversation and learn some important story bits. And then in trying to get out, I kept alarming these guards, and I could not figure a way to get out of there without someone seeing me. And so finally, I got into that situation. The guy saw me. I killed him, and then a bunch of other guards started coming. So I threw like this smoke grenade or something to distract a bunch of them all at once, and then I just ran out of there. And I literally ran my way to victory.
Yep.
I escaped the nightclub, and at that point, they could no longer find me. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, I don't know that I've ever really played a game where I felt like I felt very happy and satisfied about running away from a conflict and actually succeeding because of
that. Well, yeah, like where you run away from something, but it's not but you're not actually avoiding what the game wants you to do.
Right.
Right. I ran out of there because that was a fucking bad situation and I shouldn't have been in it. I already had what I needed, so I survived. That was the mission was get what you need and then get out of there alive. And that's what I did. And I didn't need to kill a bunch of people to do it.
There's a mini quest. There's lots of mini quests in this game, but there's one where you're basically busting up a sex slave operation in Hengsha. And the whole thing just goes off the cliff because basically, I mean, without spoiling it too much, you intrude with the wrong client present in the building. And And if you go into the wrong door, because, I mean, basically you're just there to decapitate everybody involved in the sex slave operation. You're not really particularly worried about the customers. If you bust in the wrong door, and there's no real way to know that unless you've climbed up the side of the building and are looking in their balconies. Basically, he calls the Hangsha security force, and the whole building just gets stormed. And like, it's just a fucking – because they're coming up the stairs. They're coming in the elevators. They've all got riot shields. It's just fucking chaos. So I had to basically descend down the side of the building just by jumping down balconies. And then they saw me in the hall – in the alleyway, and I just ran and climbed up another building and just started spraying fire as I ran from them. And eventually I got away.
But see, that's cool, though, because a lot of times, you know, stealth games will – you know, they really do have sort of a – when something like that happens, they really do have an end game. Like, oh, you can try to get away, but really, the entire place will be flooded with, you know, 1,000 guys that you really can't get away from. It's just a big pain in your ass until they finally kill you.
Or it's the opposite.
Like Metal Gear. That's Metal Gear.
Oh, Metal Gear, it's that or the opposite of, oh, well, you've walked into this next room, so you've just vanished.
Yeah.
And we're no longer concerned about you. This situation, they pursued me, but I vanished into the tops of the buildings.
But again, like, this is partly an RPG. When you run away from these conflicts, do you feel like you've just given up on a whole bunch of experience points? Do you feel like
no? Because there's lots of quests you can do to get more experience. I mean, there are a lot of quests in this game, and I mean, you don't want to fight. I mean, not all the time. Hengsh is a great example because the security forces are everywhere. You don't want to get in a pissing match with them because eventually they'll beat you. So, I mean, to an extent, they know who you are, and there are times where you just know, okay, right now, I'm kind of at ease. I'm at kind of like at a tenuous peace with them. I won't screw with them, and they won't screw with me. But there are other times where you know that you're not welcome in the city, so you have to kind of – you could try to shoot your way through them, but that might just make things worse. So the decision needs to be made of how am I going to get through the city without the security forces that are everywhere from seeing me? And that's kind of a fun challenge. Even if you haven't played the game very stealthy, you have to sort of adapt yourself to it because you can't just overrun the island. There's enough security to keep you at bay, so you have to come up with your own solution for dealing with it.
The game lets you play the way you want to, but it's also smart to give you a lot of challenges that will force you to adapt. So they'll force you to do things that your character is not necessarily good at. I mean, there are dialogue scenes where you have to try to read a character and negotiate with them and say what they need to hear, whether that's your kind of chosen path or not. It's really not much of a path in this particular game, but it's an option. And, you know, they're always kind of making you get a little bit outside your comfort zone. So you can become really powerful, but your character can't become perfect at everything.
Right. There's just not enough. There's not enough opportunity to advance for that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So that you're always, you know, you're always struggling in one area or another. And that's a good thing for gameplay. You don't want to be Superman.
No.
That's not fun.
No. And I mean, it's kind of why the Superman character as a whole isn't very compelling because he is Superman.
Well, he's particularly awful for video games because he's invincible and he can do everything. So there's really no challenge there.
Yeah.
That's kind of the trouble. So, James, why don't you wrap up new business and the episode?
Yeah, so I don't have a whole lot to talk about. I've been pretty busy lately, so I've been batting cleanup on stuff. So I cleaned out Pandora's Tower. I only had a couple towers left, so I went and I wiped them through. I do really like that game still. I think it's of the three games that it's sort of part of the collective of. We talked about this on the show last week, actually, Xenoblade and The Last Story. I think it's my personal weakest, but it's still a particularly good game. Hopefully it comes out in the U.S., although I'm not super sure it will. But I enjoyed it. You know, I probably got about 20 hours out of it. There's some really nice platforming challenges. There's some really nice level design. There's some really cool and interesting enemies, and the story is dark as hell. But it's you know, I enjoyed what the game offered, even if it does feel like you know, sometimes the camera's not right, sometimes the action can be a little repetitive, sometimes you can feel a bit worn out just climbing up and down these towers to solve puzzles. You know, it could feel a bit samey, even though the towers themselves are pretty different. There's so many of them. Eventually, it kind of feels like you're getting worn through because it's not like Zelda where they're constantly giving you new items to try out to solve puzzles because you have your equipment and that's what you have. But still, you know, it's a fun game. There's really no reason it shouldn't come out here, except for Nintendo just saying, well, it's not worth our time to even bother doing whatever minimal advertising we'd have to do. So hopefully it does. I also finished off Tales of the Abyss on the 3DS, which is now the most played game on my 3DS at 51.5 hours, which for a Tales, it seems like a big number, but for a Tales game is actually relatively low.
Yeah.
It feels a little bit easier than previous Tales games. I've never played a Tales game before where after my first encounter with the final boss, I thought, yeah, I could take him. Usually it's like my first guy at the final boss, I'm like, what the fuck just happened? In fact, it really only took me 2 shots to beat him. I have a handful of mini quests I need to solve. There's one that unlocks a small dungeon that I need to get through. So maybe another couple hours, but still, I mean, 51 hours is a pretty solid gameplay. And my game save time is 50.5. So I only lost an hour in continues, which is good because one of the things that can be frustrating about that series is that you can lose a lot of time having to continue because you can't skip the stupid dialogue scenes and boss battles on your 30th attempt at it for some reason that they still haven't figured out that maybe we don't want to see this whole dialogue again. But otherwise, yeah, it's a really fun game. It's, you know, it's something a 3DS desperately needed, a big meaty RPG that pushes the system hard. Sometimes it pushes it too hard and you get big slowdowns. Or you just get the game zoomed so far out it's hard to see all the detail, but it's good. I'm really happy with it. I kind of want another 3DS RPG right now, but we're still a bit bereft in that category. But we'll see. But yeah, that's really all I had this week. You know, I haven't got...
I think Devil Survivor Overclocked 2 is coming.
Oh, fuck. No.
Right?
Well, no, Devil Survivor 2 just came out on the DS a few months ago, which is some kind of weird mind game that Atlas is playing with us of releasing the DS sequel after the 3DS non-remake, just to prove to you how much these games are effectively the same game.
If you want a first-person simple dungeon crawler, you can also get Sword of Hope 2 on the virtual on the eShop.
That's as enticing as that sounds.
What I would suggest, and I think it's coming out fairly soon from your favorite publisher, Atlas, is Etria and Odyssey 4.
Yes.
And I've heard that the 3DS it's not a version, this is the 3DS game, it's the first one on that system. But I've heard this is by far the most accessible Etria and Odyssey game, but it's also still really good, and it has all the things that people like about Etria and Odyssey. And that's a big, meaty RPG. It may not be all that story-heavy, but at least it should be challenging and really fun to play through.
Yeah, I mean, it just... You know, we just need stuff to come and flesh that lineup out again. I mean, it's if you're looking for something for an excuse to play your 3DS for 50 hours, this game will do it. I mean, there is 50 hours of gameplay here, but that's it, though. I mean, you might want to save that for like a long trip.
Yeah. And actually, on the note of 3DS, as we wrap up here, I am very happy to report that our listener's suggestion from a couple weeks ago seems to have worked. I was able to go to the website of my local police precinct and file a report request online, and the website said, you know, this system is only for reporting police reports or only reporting lost or stolen property within our jurisdiction. But it gave me, and when I put in New York for the location, he gave me a warning and it said, do you want to submit it anyway? And I was like, hell yeah. So it let me do it anyway. And I wrote in the description note, here's why I'm doing this. It's because I was on vacation and I actually had called ahead to the police office and talked with someone there. And they said, well, you know, it can't hurt to go ahead and try it. And so I did, and it worked, and my police report was approved, and I have it now. I have a PDF of it that I can send to Nintendo. So that's on my to-do list this weekend, is call Nintendo customer support and start getting on that system ready, because the XL is out in just another week.
Yep.
So I'm very excited, and this looks like this whole thing might turn out okay.
It looks like we don't need account-based...
Yeah, obviously yeah. We don't need accounts because you can just file police reports all over the place.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, Nintendo was right all along.
Yes.
You know, I think it helped that I had my serial number, and you know, one of the good things about Club Nintendo is that if you've registered your system with Club Nintendo, which you probably did right away because it's worth a ton of coins.
Yeah, and you should.
It extends your warranty
as well. And you can actually
do
it straight from the system when you turn it on.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, with 3DS you can, yeah. So if you go to the Club Nintendo website and log in and go to my account, you can actually see the serial number of all the hardware that you've ever registered there. So I just pulled it right off the website, bam, and it's even now in some kind of national registry of lost property. So if anyone ever finds it, they can trace my original 3DS back to me. I wouldn't count on that. I think that number has probably been scratched out by now, but... you know, whatever. It's in there. More importantly, I have the police report. It's worth probably over $100 worth of digital software. So when I get my new XL, I'm looking forward to getting that thing set up. So I can't say 100% for sure that it worked yet, but it looks like it's going to work. So I'm really excited, and I just wanted to let everybody know that this may be an option for you, depending on how cooperative your local police department is.
Yep.
So... all right. Well, that's going to wrap up this episode, and wanted to remind everybody that the retroactive forum thread is still open, and we will try to get to that game in a week or two, I hope. What this delay just means that you get an extra opportunity. So if you haven't had time to play it yet, or if you got to play some and you forgot to write in the forum comments, you still have time to do so. And we are looking forward to that. Trust me, it's not because we don't want to talk about the game. It's just circumstances, man. It's just summer and the anniversary and everything just stacking up. So we're going to get to that as soon as we can, and hope you will participate with us. Also, you can send an email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com because we will be getting back to listener mail very, very soon, probably next week. So thanks everybody for the nice comments on episode 300, but we also need your substantive and fascinating questions about the world of Nintendo and video games. So please keep those coming. And finally, I wanted to give a plug for our sister podcast, Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, hosted by Michael TYP Cole, who you heard last week on RFN 300. And on the newest episode, I'm on there co-hosting with Mike, and we do a lot of really fun music, including one of my favorite game soundtracks of the past few years, VVVVVV. So I hope you will go check that out. It's a really, really fun episode. And there's some other games that we've talked about quite recently with some interesting music. So if you've never listened to Radio Trivia before, you really should. It's great stuff. So that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks everybody for making it through 301. We will be back in full force next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Peace.
Woo!
Later. Let's just say I've been around a couple of mechanical sphincters in my time.
It's not a party until you've hired three hookers.